Hello and welcome to the Sports Loft Podcast, where we talk about the intersection of technology with the worlds of sports and entertainment. Today we have a blockbuster conversation ready, which I'm pretty excited about. This is the evolution of sports sponsorship. And to co-host it with me, as ever, the grandee, grand vizier, leader of everything Sports Loft, joining us from a hotel room in some unnamed city on the east coast of the United States, Charlie Greenwood. How you doing, Charlie?
Morning, Yanni. How you doing? It's a little early here, but yeah, all good. Got up especially to hear your dulcet tone.
Oh, always grinding. I love it. Well, to speak about sports sponsorship and its evolution, something very near and dear to my heart for anybody who knows me, we have two guests joining. I will start with Sally Moore. Sally is the global sponsorship lead for Sage, and she runs Sage's sponsorship portfolio, including Major League Baseball, Six Nations Rugby, The 100 Cricket, where Sage is the official insights partner for both of those latter ones. Sally, welcome to the Sports Loft Podcast. Fantastic to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Annie.
And to complement the conversation, we have Jason Saban, a partner at Charles Russell Speechley's international law firm. Jason's a contract specialist who has a focus on the law of technology, media, and telecommunications. Say that five times quickly. Sport, retail, and leisure. And Jason has significant experience in the world of sponsorship, as well as digital media, and has worked very closely with Sally on a number of deals. So we look forward to diving into that conversation. Jason, welcome to the Sports Loft Podcast.
Thank you, Yanni. Looking forward to it.
We're really looking forward to it too. So, as ever, because this is a sports and technology podcast, we start with people's favorite sporting moment of the week. And in no particular order, I will throw it to you, Jason. What was your favorite sporting moment of this past week?
It's a favorite moment, but also a slightly depressing moment. It was Marcus Rashford scoring in the 8th minute, and for once, Manchester United looking like a decent football team, which was wonderful for all of 30 minutes.
Yes, it didn't go quite to plan after that. He had a couple of shall we say heavy touches, which belied his particularly sublime strike. Manchester derby aside, and the right or wrong result depending on your point of view, Charlie, what was your favorite sports moment of the week?
Well, as I'm in the States, I thought I'd pick one that is over here, and a slightly obscure one from an American markets bit, which was the NRL game in Las Vegas. I was actually in Boston on Saturday night, and we ended up traipsing around at least three or four sports bars trying to find one in the States that was actually showing it. But they had 40,000 people for a rugby league match in Las Vegas, which actually looked amazing. As long as the cameras didn't pan to the top tier, but as long as it stayed on the bottom tier, it looked fantastic. And I think it was about 35,000 Aussies had flown over to Las Vegas on package deals, which apparently injected some huge amount of both beer consumption and gambling into the local economy. And it was really fun to watch. And actually, the other bit was quite fun, that on the table next to us were probably four or five American guys who'd been watching the basketball, and when they turned it onto the rugby, these guys were absolutely transfixed. Like, that. Where's the padding? Where, like, what about what all that blood? And they're carrying on. So yes, it was great fun to watch.
Well, I won't tell the full story about my wife getting me into huge trouble one time when we went to watch a college American football game at ASU, and she turned around in the middle of the student section and said, basically, this is rugby for. Well, she used a term which we're not going to mention on the podcast, but she said, this is, yes, exactly. This is rugby for wimps, right? And I rapidly had to exit stage left. Definitely saving the best for last. Sally, what has been your favorite sporting moment?
Mine's not strictly speaking a sporting moment, but I've been quite taken with the release of the film around the 71 Women's World Cup. I think Copa 71.
Yes.
Super interesting story, and really drove home for me the drama and the lengths we still have to go to around women's sport. I think it was, I was listening to something with Ian Wright, and he was saying, you know, when you compare the performance in women's football compared to the men's game, you have to remember that there's a 50-year lag there in performance. And so the pipeline of talent, the culture around it, has still got a way to go to catch up with the men's game. And I think nothing epitomizes that more than the than this film, and just an extraordinary story. Yeah, quite taken with that, and quite fitting given that we're almost at International Women's Day.
Absolutely. The family is very much looking forward to getting down to the Emirates for the last game of the season of Arsenal Women against Leicester City. So I'm very much looking forward to that. On that note, because I am a big basketball fan, as people know, my favorite moments are two moments. I'll cheat. The first is LeBron James becoming the first basketball player ever to score 40,000 points in the NBA, which is fabulous, at the ripe old age of 30, however old he is now, 39, I think, which is incredible. But perhaps more importantly, Caitlin Clark, the guard for the Iowa women's college basketball team, becoming the all-time NCAA basketball leading scorer this week, which is a fantastic story, and one which garnered the recognition that it deserved, which may not have been the case even 2 to 3 years ago. And so it really does speak, Sally, to the point of the growth of women's sports and the attention that it is getting. And very much looking forward to watching Caitlin ply her trade as a professional, in the WNBA very soon. But let us move swiftly on to the topic of the day, which is the evolution of sports sponsorship, looking at some trends. And we'll start with, because we're on the theme of favorites, let's stick with the theme of favorites. Sally, you've been in this world for a while now. You'll have seen a lot of things, and we'll dive into what Sage is doing and sort of some really exciting announcements that have just taken place, which I can't wait to get my teeth into. But give us an example of some of your favorite examples of sponsorship in recent years, and what you think of when you think of sponsorship.
Sure. I think great sponsorships come down to authenticity, and really being able to tell your brand and your customer story within a sports environment. It can be quite a tricky thing to do if you're, for example, a B2B brand, or let's just say you have quite a dry product. It can be quite a tricky thing to do, but being able to surface the real kind of DNA of your brand and the reason that you exist, I think is the real key to success. It's not a job around ticketing or brand slapping. It's about how do we tell stories within this environment. My current example, which I'm smiling because it actually is within one of our environments, and actually I won't lie, I do bristle a little bit because I'm a little bit jealous. But Compare the Market have done a really beautiful job on the 100. They obviously bring their brand to life in a very playful manner, and they are their product is very transactional. But the way that they can kind of create that emotional connection with their customer, prospective customer, really interesting the way they've done that within the environment of cricket and the environment of the 100, which is a very playful environment. So from their idents to the way they show it up in stadia, the whole guest experience, they really make that a playful and joyous experience. And you can't help but have a wry smile when you see them turn up within the sport that we love. So really a fan of the way that Compare the Market have done that, and done that with a beautiful simplicity, which leads me to my second favourite, and that is Paddy Power at the Darts. That is an absolutely incredible example of how you bring your brand to life in quite a unique environment. They are cheeky. And you can't deny that every way they show up is slightly cheeky. Mm. And they're speaking to an audience that's naturally engaged in a brand story or in a corporate story. But the way that they show up is very authentic to both the sport and their brand. And it's all done beautifully. So two quite playful examples, but my current favorites.
Jason, over to you. Give us some of your favorite examples that you've seen.
I think the Paddy Power one's excellent, and I remember those quite well. What's interesting about Paddy Power is it's incredibly sophisticated marketing. You know, it comes across as wonderfully simple, but the thought and the intelligence and the clearance that goes behind that is sensational. It's really impressive. Probably the two things for me would be Nike's sponsorship of the England women's football team, which is one we're quite close to. And again, they put so much effort into it. It's really elevated the profile of the team within the UK. And, you know, some of the promotions that was done around it, you know, the images off the White Cliffs of Dover around the major buildings in the UK was really, really, you know, tangible and wonderful for the football team, I thought. One we did more recently on the tech side is for the International Tennis Federation, which is in relation to the Billie Jean King Cup and a partnership we did with Microsoft. Which was really interesting because for the first time, the teams could use a Microsoft tool, data analytics, to track the power of their serving, how the ball was moving during the pitch, during the match. So it just became a really interesting thing. And we'll come on to this a bit later about how technology is influencing sport and sponsorship. So that was a fun one to be involved in.
There are two really interesting themes coming out of that I want to pick up on. One, and we'll do it in order, but one is, Sally, what you mentioned about authenticity. You know, all of those examples are examples of a brand that has established its identity and is very clear in how it communicates to its customers, or its prospective customers, and then pulls that down or pulls it up, you know, depending on how you look at it, into its sports sponsorship and uses that in a really cool way. The second theme is sort of real integration and real added value, showcasing either a piece of technology or showcasing your product and enhancing the fan experience, and really, really proving that. So, you know, obviously, badging is a thing of the past. No smart marketer is going to sit there and kind of just look at the amount of eyeballs that can be driven by, you know, pitch side branding or something like that. You know, it's obviously a hygiene factor for some sponsorships, but it's not the be all and end all. So, Sally, taking that first point, that brand authenticity and how it looks like and how it feels like, how do you guys work to take the core brand values and implement them into a sporting context? And it might be worth just giving a little bit of background about Sage for the listeners, just so that everybody understands the context as well.
Sure. So there's two things that make Sage unique. We're a technology company. We are 40 years old. There aren't many 40-year-old tech companies out there. We're also one of maybe two FTSE tech companies. So we're FTSE listed, based in the UK. And we help millions of small businesses around the world to manage their accounts, finance, HR, payroll. No one started a business to do to file their taxes. So we can take the friction and the pain away from running your day-to-day business so that you dare to dream. So engine room with the economy, small and medium-sized businesses, we can take away that friction so that those businesses can thrive. As a UK business, and I wouldn't say we're similar to Paddy Power, but the essence of it is very key in that we have a very clear brand values, tone of voice and purpose. You know, you can hear from the way that I talk about Sage, it's very clear about our raison d'etre. And we believe that we're knocking down barriers so that all SMBs can thrive. So because of that, we look at our sponsorships through the lens of our key audiences. And our audiences aren't just customers. They are potential customers. They are our colleagues. They are our communities. They are our shareholders. And so when we think about how we're going to bring our sponsorships to life, we marry those two things. So that brand purpose and our kind of raison d'etre and our DNA with what it can achieve for those key audiences. And so your point on integration is really important. The sponsorship is absolutely knitted into the framework of our business. It is not just a marketing discipline. It is not just a brand play. It sits across all aspects of our business. So it might be investor relations or internal communications or talent acquisition. And we really believe that sponsorship has a role to play in all of those disciplines. So the way that we think and structure our activation is incredibly broad, but all adds up to our brand purpose. And I think that when you see Sage turn up, whether it be the rugby or the baseball, that builds that authenticity, because we all ladder up to that single brand, that brand vision.
So talk a little bit about each of those examples. What was it? And baseball might be a really interesting one, right? Because as a UK company, you know, Major League Baseball, not that much penetration in the UK. You know, people sort of know about it. People wear baseball caps and they recognize that, but that's not somewhere that you would show up naturally. So what was it about that made it particularly appealing, and how do you tie it together, and what are the objectives that is fulfilling for you?
So in the US, we have a brand awareness challenge. We are not the market leader as far as share of market's concerned in the US. In North America, we have very low brand awareness, and we're up against some pretty, you know, the behemoths in our industry based out of the US. So baseball provides for us a platform for reach and for credibility. So baseball, as you say, is, you know, America's national pastime, and it comes with that historic credibility as well. So not only do we get the reach from the 2000 plus games that are played within a regular season, but we also get the kind of joint brand association of partnering with the likes of the MLB. We are the official finance software provider to the MLB. And so that credibility and that shared IP means that we can penetrate kind of consciousness of our potential customer a little bit more in the US. And when we look at the portfolio, that's got a very different objective than if we look in Europe. We've got very high brand awareness, but perhaps we have an understanding challenge in some of our markets. So the way that we activate feels very different. In North America, because it's around reach, you're right, we're perhaps looking more at frequency than we are around depth. Whereas in Europe, we definitely focus more on depth. So job to be done in the US looks very different to what it does in Europe, but still all adds up to that same piece, still very much authentic to our brand.
Sally, on the you mentioned obviously Major League Baseball, and you got the rugby ones. What are you noticing are the differences in the way that you have to approach a sponsorship in the US in terms of the way that you activate, the way that you think about it, the way that you structure it, versus how that you'd operate in the UK? Are you noticing differences in the market, in the different types of rights that you get? How, from a brand's perspective, how are you finding the differences between the two?
It's vastly different. It's almost a completely different discipline. In the US, just from a pure deal structure perspective, much more flexibility around the rights that you buy. So obviously you're buying the IP and the ability to associate yourself with the rights holder. But then when it comes to asset lists, there's much more flexibility, and flexibility within the season as well. So we can dial up and down, whether it be we want to dial up media and dial down ticketing, or we want to focus more on digital for a month. You know, there's much more flexibility within the US than we get in Europe, which feels very much more like here's a term sheet and here's a list of deliverables and here's what you get for your money. And that comes with opportunity and challenge, right? So we need to be, not that we're not tuned in, but much more tuned into our measurement criteria in the US so that we can have that ability to dial up and dial down if we need to within a season, and be super responsive to what we're seeing within our metrics. Also in the US, what I would say is that flexibility also comes with an opportunity to innovate within activation that might not necessarily be so prevalent in Europe. But I would also say that we as a European brand seem to bring a different way of thinking to activation that our rights holders in the US, it's new for them. So the way that we think about cut through and content creation and using talent, and how we really bring that back to our customer, that seems to be relatively new for our rights holder in the US. I think it's just because it's such a broad platform that you need to be quite a sophisticated engine to be able to make the most of that. And we're incredibly blessed in the US in that we've got the capability to do that. So vast differences, almost to the point that I would say it's a completely different discipline.
Jason, does that chime with you? Because you've worked on deals across multiple geographies, multiple sports. How do you see the comparative markets?
It's actually quite interesting, because if you're looking at it from a legal perspective, it's probably the opposite. But the activation piece is as Sally says, but in the US, it's a very traditional market still in relation to the contract negotiation. But certainly in the ones we've been involved in, the contract is this, and you can go a little bit around it. You can do a little bit if you need to, but it's very much traditional as it is. And Sally, you'll remember this when we were working on the MLB. But once you've signed it, the commercial teams get involved, and yes, let's make the most out of this opportunity. And it becomes a very different environment. In the UK and Europe, the legal perspective, it's definitely moved to become more flexible. So the contract, the lawyers are almost working with the commercial team to make the contract really fit the proposal and the structure of the deal. But the problem you have there, as Sally alludes to, is once you've got that structure in place and the contract in place, there's not very much movement around it. So it's, you know, in a way, you've got two different models. If you put them together, you'd have the perfect legal and commercial model. But at the moment, they're almost fighting each other.
Whoever knew that approaching the UK and the US would be the solution to everything. Let me take you back, Jason, to the point about integration, which is a fascinating one to me. You know, as you may know, I spent quite a bit of time in motorsport, and obviously integration is a huge part of a lot of the sponsorship deals, right? It's like, we will not use your technology unless you are a sponsor, and therefore there's a huge component to that. But we're seeing more and more of that in other sports as well, and other rights holders starting to think in that way. Give us some examples of how difficult is that to negotiate? How tricky is it to get that kind of deal across the line? And then how difficult are clients finding to activate it? Or is it something that you know, people are getting more and more into because they know they need to deliver that for a valuable sponsorship?
It's interesting. The activation piece isn't so difficult, I'd say, because generally the parties are coming to it and knowing what they're trying to achieve from that commercial technology perspective. From a legal perspective, it's an entirely different contract. So, you know, you talked earlier about how sponsorships evolve from just sticking a badge on a shirt. And then, you know, as Charlie will know, then, you know, as more sophisticated sponsors came to the market, they potentially take over other parts of the project. So they get involved in the merchandising, the digital side of that sponsorship deal. Now with tech coming into it, you're not really looking at a sponsorship contract. You're almost looking at a technology contract, because if the sponsor is going to be involved with bringing technology to the table, who's going to own it? How are you going to ensure it works? You know, what are the service levels on this whole project? So you're almost starting from a software license and adding in the sponsorship layers. So, you know, a couple of times we've seen a standard sponsorship contract come across where there is a technology element and it just doesn't work because it hasn't thought about the other nuances you require when you're actually negotiating a technology deal. So it's interesting to see how that is developing within the industry, because it's going to become more and more common, because technology providers are definitely very excited about this world now.
Absolutely. Sally, from your perspective, this integration insight, you focus quite a lot on being the insights partner and sort of being able to deliver the insights and improve the fan experience. How do you do that? What is that? How does that tie back to the message? Just walk us through that that element.
Again, you know, synergistic to what we do for our customers, we provide insight into your business. If you're a small business, and COVID is a great example. So in the UK, when COVID hit, the government support for you to be able to pay your staff, but they wouldn't work as part of our furlough scheme, that feels like such a gift from the government. But if you're a small business, how do you possibly make a decision around who you're going to furlough, how you get the money, how you then pay them that money? That's a huge challenge for a small business. So we built a product in a matter of days where companies could have the insight into who was on payroll, how much you were paying them, what their contribution was, and then how to pay them through furlough. That insight is something that we want to parallel when it comes to sport. So rugby's a great example, right? The broadcast that you watch for the Six Nations is very similar to the broadcast that we were watching 20 years ago. But the audience that is coming through to watch rugby, survey after survey will tell you that that Gen Z audience want to understand why the decisions are being made on the pitch. Well, what the decisions are that are being made by the players on the pitch and what goes into that decision-making process. They want a stats-heavy dual screen experience. So we could see this gap and the opportunity to be able to provide more insight so that the fans had a more engaging experience of watching rugby, but also players, coaches, teams had more insight to drive better performance. Again, very similar to what we do for small businesses. So in rugby, we sponsored a piece of technology from Sportable, who are the makers of the smart ball. So an RFID chip that sits within the ball itself that can measure velocity, distance, where the ball's gone out, in real time. And it's got AI that sits underneath that can therefore present findings and conclusions to players, fans, coaches. We were the name sponsor on that. So on the broadcast, it was labeled as Sage when the insights came up. And that's very similar to what we've done across our sport. So the brief to our rights holders is that we want to be additive to the fan experience through providing additional insight through technology.
And that relationship has now grown, and I'm really, really excited to talk about this. You have now entered into a bigger partnership relationship with Sportable themselves, the providers of the ball, which is a unique partnership as far as I can remember, where you're partnering with the technology as a brand directly with the technology that is then coming in to enhance that experience. So talk about that a little bit, because that'll open so many other questions and avenues about the future of sponsorship and what brands need to be looking at.
Sure. So yeah, we've been working with Sportable through our Six Nations relationship. But if we take sponsorship out of the discussion for a little bit and talk about what Sportable technology does, they are building a data network of sport. So their smartball technology doesn't just operate within rugby. They operate globally in multitude of sports, college football, emerging in soccer, Canadian rules, Aussie rules. So they have a vast global portfolio. Now, from that portfolio, the data that they're surfacing, there is reams and reams of data. But within that, there are real nuggets and interesting stories that are beneficial to fans, to broadcasters, to press, to players, to coaches. So this network of sport, you can imagine if we open that up, open APIs where you could add wearable technology, or it could be on your smartwatch. You know, the possibilities are endless. Now, this is almost exactly what we are doing for small businesses. We are building a network of data that we can open up to the likes of open banking, to suppliers, so that data becomes that kind of lubricates performance, exactly the same as what Sportable are doing within sport. So those parallels between our businesses were really obvious through our discussions. Now, if you bring the sponsorship world back in, we could see the opportunity to partner with Sportable, not only to help build their business, but also some skill sharing. So our technology, their technology, particularly with the specter of AI, there's so much opportunity for us to be able to share technology or expertise. They're a small business. They are thriving. We want to help them grow. So through investment and a co-marketing agreement directly with Sportable, we are now co-branded. So it's Sportable powered by Sage across all of their owned and operated. And then we're going to build a global sports index where we are surfacing some of the stories that this kind of network of data is presenting. So lots of wonderful marketing opportunities and also some really exciting opportunities for us to work in sports where we might not necessarily have a direct relationship with the rights holder. Now, saying all of that, Sportable make their money by selling their technology to the rights holders. And the rights holders tend to white label that technology. We don't want to interrupt that process. And so Sportable and the rights holders have a direct relationship that we don't need to be involved in unless we want to be. And then we can have a conversation with the rights holders. So sort of a preferred partner. But it does mean that it opens up the ecosystem for us so that we can speak directly to the rights holders at the appropriate time and we don't lose any opportunity. So it's quite an interesting structure. And as you say, I'm not sure I can think of any examples where it's almost sponsorship of a technology rather than a rights holder environment. But since launch, the response has been really interesting. And actually, the focus seems to be more on the technology itself and potentially what that knowledge exchange could do rather than the kind of sponsorship story.
And Sally, how did you sell that internally? I mean, it's one thing normally selling a sponsorship internally and you've got to go through all of that, but people know sponsorships. They know that I'm going to get ticketing and branding and things like that. This is quite different that you were taking to the table. What was the sort of process that you had to do internally to get people to go, oh yeah, I understand how that can work.
And let me just piggyback on that as well, just to add, did anybody raise the question of what happens if Sportable gets used in a sport where the rights holder already has a data or insights partner? So, you know, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but let's just say for the sake of argument, Microsoft is the insights partner of somewhere, and suddenly that technology, Sportable powered by Sage, is driving insights that are then used by a competitor.
Yeah.
Whether that came up in the conversations.
Yeah, I'll cover that one first. So yes, that is a risk that could happen. What we would say is that we actually don't want to interrupt that relationship between the rights holder and Sportable. So yes, we're prepared to take the risk that in some environments there may already be a sponsor who will take ownership. So for example, in rugby, in the World Cup, perhaps Capgemini would, they own insights. I think that's fine because actually we get to tell a story above at a global sports level and then underneath as well. So we're also working really closely with Sportable on what we call our Sage Foundation, so our philanthropic arm. We're teaching STEM skills in the community using sports technology and we're using Sportable. So we get to tell a great community story. We're helping our communities, back to my point around audience. But also we get to tell a higher level story about what data does for global sport. And we don't need to be brought down into the specific sports themselves. And Microsoft or any of our competitors, Microsoft is the direct competitor, but any of our direct competitors can go well within the rights holder environment that they operate in. But we get the opportunity to kind of go up a level and tell a global sports story.
I was going to say, I love that about the storytelling around STEM skills. I mean, and I think it also comes back to what you were saying before about, Sage has what's the best way of putting it? It's not the most exciting product when you're talking about accountancy. But for, you know, if kids are learning numeric skills, STEM skills like that, put it in the context of what's happening in a sport or rugby and actually doing maths on the back of that rather than in an accountancy piece. You just think, imagine the level of engagement for those kids must be significantly higher. I think that's a fantastic way to activate that.
And they are the entrepreneurs of tomorrow. Hmm. So we know that actually what stops you starting a business isn't cash, it's confidence. So we're teaching those kids to have the confidence to be able to start a business. And so it really comes back down to the real core of why Sage exists. So above and below on the rights holder piece when it comes to our relationship with Sportable. To your point around how we sold this internally, it's a great question. I'm very persuasive. I think one of our brand values is around being bold. And when you look at our position in the US in particular, where we are we do have to have a challenger mentality. We don't have the deep pockets of some of our competitors, and we do have very low brand awareness. So those bold ideas that frankly are a bit of a punt are actually embraced by our leadership. Something that hasn't been done before, but that you can see the rationale behind was actually embraced. And I'm very proud of Sage for the fact that they will embrace bold ideas like this. But, you know, you can see through our discussion that actually there's huge opportunity here. And so for our leadership, they could also see the opportunity. what is quite fortuitous is that Sportsball uses AI as its kind of underlying technology over and above the hardware that they have. We are just embarking on our kind of AI story. We've just launched an AI product. So it fitted very well within our kind of jigsaw of storytelling around AI as well. I'm sure we'll talk about this, but there aren't many sports where you can really stand up an AI story. So for sponsorship, that's a tough ask at the moment. Whereas having this relationship with Sportsball, there was our capability to be able to create a narrative around AI that was authentic to sport.
And how much do you need to, as part of this, bring, say, the media partners along with you as well? So obviously, if I'm watching a game of, let's use rugby as the example, but if I'm not watching a game of rugby, bringing those insights into the commentary, into actually the broadcast so that people engage with it, makes such a difference. And for many commentators who have been commentating for maybe 15, 20, 25 years, these sorts of stats have not necessarily been available to them before, and actually maybe not are not necessarily used to actually talking about them and bringing that into their storytelling. So how do you work with, through, I guess, through the rights holder, but also with the media partners to bring that to life?
Yeah, that is the nub of the challenge that we have at the moment within our activation. We can bring the broadcaster with us so far in that, as you say, we can present the insights on screen, but unless the commentators, the pundits are pointing to those insights and really talking about what's driving that insight and the implication of that insight, they're just numbers on a screen. So we spend a huge amount of time, money, effort, resource on educating talent and the broadcasters on what sits behind those numbers on the screen. So particularly in, actually now across sport, but let's take rugby as an example. We spend lots of time with talent. So Maggie Alfonsi is one of our brand ambassadors. She ex-England captain. She has won a couple of Six Nations. She's an absolutely fantastic brand ambassador, but she also understands the potential power of technology. And so by having her as a brand ambassador, spending time with her and getting her really into the weeds of what the insights are, when she's then talent on screen and commentating, she is bringing that into her kind of natural delivery. We haven't cracked it yet, but I think it's a long road, but I do think that the crux of this is talent and getting them on board. The broadcasters, even the most forward-thinking broadcaster, they're not quite there yet unless the talent is demanding it. So that's why we spend so much time on education.
I think just one point on that, Sally, is that the audience will start demanding it when they see it there as well. And that will be a definite evolution.
Yeah, just one example. We ran a campaign with TikTok for the last Six Nations. So we partnered with TikTok on their Six Nations hub. So any Six Nations content was presented through the hub on TikTok. And it's so interesting because obviously that is the ultimate Gen Z audience, right? But when you look at the most engaged with content, it is data-led, it's insight-led, and it's talent-led. So they want talent talking about what is happening on screen and why. We had some of the most engaged with rugby content ever on the platform because of that. So Jason's absolutely bang on. This next generation of sports viewership will absolutely demand it. And if they don't get it from the broadcasters, they'll get it themselves from social media, and they will create it themselves. So the broadcasters have to keep up.
And when you look at things like the alt streams that, you know, are increasingly getting prevalence, and there's lots of sports now. I mean, Amazon's showing of the NFL on a Thursday night, for example, is a really good one of that, where you've got lots of different streams. Do you see a point where almost you get to having one stream that is very stats driven, one that is maybe much more sort of almost the pub style commentary, you know, and you've almost got that very much more targeted sort of streams around those?
Totally agree. Yeah, totally agree. I think the second screen experience, the joy of it is that you can choose to have which experience you want. So whether you want personality, you can find that. If you want stats, you can find that. I don't think we should underestimate the power of interactivity as well. The on-pitch content creators, that is what the next generation are looking for. So I don't think it just sits with the broadcaster, but they also can't take their foot off the floor when it comes to innovation.
So Jason, Sally's, you know, very forward-thinking and has done some incredible stuff, and the partnership with Sportable is as we talked about, really cool. How are you seeing the market develop in the deals that you're seeing come across your table? If you could give a percentage split is probably, you know, too difficult, but sort of a gist of how many are still, you know, sponsorship, you know, badging, logo here, you get this many meters, you get this many minutes, you get whatever it is, and how many rights holders are actually demanding more, sorry, how many brands are demanding more of the rights holders and more storytelling, more authentic integration, more showcasing?
I think it's increasingly rare that you just get the traditional sponsorship because it's just moved forward too far now. The sponsors all have great people like Sally driving them with great ideas and new opportunities. So they're not going to settle for just here's the badge. It's not like in the old days where the chief exec of the Royal Bank of Scotland liked Formula One, so he put it into there. You know, it's completely changed that market. You know, from time to time you will see it, but increasingly, no, it's much more sophisticated than that, which makes it more complex because you're then having to capture on a contract some nuance or something different, which you're thinking, oh, I've never done that before. How do you get this right and not in trouble? But that makes it more interesting in many ways as well.
And Sally, in that context, how much more sophisticated are the approaches becoming to you from rights holders? Because you're obviously now, you know, you've got three major properties. You've done some really cool stuff. How much smarter are the approaches, and how smart do they need to be to even crack through the 30, 40, 50 cold emails you get every day?
Yeah. I'm thinking a way of putting this politely. It's not as progressive as I would expect it to be as a brand. And sometimes, frankly, I'm a little perplexed because, as you've said, the trend is so marked in the way that brands think, and yet commercial teams still don't seem to have kept a pace. And so the approaches that I get do tend to be fairly out of the box, whereas in any other environment, you would know your client, right? I do find it slightly frustrating that it does feel slightly out of the box. What I would say is that with the rights holders that we work with, we really feel that we have a responsibility to work with them. So it's not just their responsibility to move forward and innovate. We, as a tech brand and as a brand with time, resource, people and skills, we're also there to partner with them to help bring them forward as well. So part of the brief that we give to our rights holders is, how can we help you? So Sportable being a great example, you know, could we bring Sportable technology into cricket, for example? Or, you know, could we help you with AI? So I think there's it's definitely a true partnership model with our rights holders. And actually, we're very lucky with the ECB, for example, particularly because we work with them on the 100, which, for those of you that are not cricket fans, is a very simple format of cricket that is hugely diverse. Men and women play for parity of prize fund. They play back-to-back games, super simple, very family orientated. And because the 100 is what it is, the ECB are very keen to innovate. And their broadcaster, Sky Sport, is very keen to innovate with us. So increasingly, I see that if you can have the right conversation at the right time with the rights holder, then you can bring them with you. But we're very lucky in our relationships. And I would say that 90% of the stuff that crosses my desk just hasn't kept pace with the way that we think as a brand.
And Sally, is that because it's not creative enough? It's not tailored enough to you? Is it there isn't enough data being presented to you to support the arguments? I mean, I've often seen a lot of sponsorship decks where you look at the data in there and you think, and beyond the most obvious of, oh yeah, we've got this many Facebook followers and this many Twitter followers, you're kind of like, is that it? But what's lacking?
All of the above. So objective-centric proposals. I don't see many of them. I don't see much around the changing face of the sport. So you wouldn't need to be a rocket scientist to look at our sponsorships and understand what we're trying to achieve. And so if we want to be at the cutting edge of sport and to be additive to the sports that we're in, if you're going to come to me with a proposal, then I want to understand that. And what is it that we can do with you to move that sport forward? And so that kind of understanding Sage, understanding what else we've done, but also understanding the wider market dynamics and how we can help them, I very rarely see that.
I think one observation that I'd make, I think Sally, you're absolutely right. The rights holders are very reactive, but once you come to them with the proposal and the idea yourself, they generally want to move to it. They think this is a great idea. So I think there's a role actually to be played by the third parties advising the right holders and the sponsors. So the agencies, you know, tracking the market, ensuring that it's not just a generic proposal that's going out there, but actually seeing the trends and saying, this is a great opportunity to do something a bit different and being proactive rather than just sending out the usual template. I think there's definitely a shift that needs to take place there.
And where would you like to see sponsorships move towards? What's your kind of vision of what you would like from an ideal partnership going forward?
For me, sponsorship sits in between brand and reputation. So it is not just a brand play. Sponsorship should build the reputation of any organization. Now, the way that you build reputation is to really embed yourself, back to my audience point, within the audience framework. So I increasingly try and shift our team's mentality away from kind of pure marketing driven objectives and more towards that kind of reputation play. And how do we build Sage's profile and the way that you think about Sage across all of our stakeholder audiences? And by shifting sponsorship into more of a strategic role, it means that we can have deeper impact. So back to the point around partnering with Sportsball on their technology so we can enhance our own capabilities internally. To the point around how we bring our colleagues with us and how we enhance their experience of being a Sage colleague. The STEM skills program, how we're bringing the community with us and building the entrepreneurs of tomorrow. That shifts sponsorship further up into a more strategic role than simply being something that we do within the marketing team.
Very cool.
And Sally, one of the bit that I think is really interesting, because we've talked a lot about data in this, but often within the sort of the data that is used within the activation of the sponsorship, one of the things that we're hearing a lot is the power of people's sports fandom to then result in data capture as well. So getting information about consumers. Often that's put in a B2C environment. So I want lots of data captured about all the fans. But from the perspective of Sage looking at this, are you looking at your sponsorship as an opportunity to capture more data about your users, your potential users? How are you looking at that sort of side of it?
In the UK in particular, we are almost a B2C brand. A small business owner, most of us are. If you have a side hustle or you lease out a flat, or then you too have to file your taxes. I hope you are. Because of that, we are almost a B2C brand. And so understanding that fan audience is as important to us as it would be for any kind of direct-to-consumer brand. in North America, we have a much more pointed audience. So we are targeting CFOs particularly. Now, to reach that CFO audience, we know they sit within an MLB environment. And actually, we're very lucky in that the MLB have very rich data around their fan base. So we can go broad in the way that we show up in broadcast, but we can also be very targeted to a CFO audience through the MLB and through the data that they operate in. So we absolutely value the data that the rights holders are collating around their fan audience. But we would never do anything to reach that audience unless it was credible within the sports that we operate in. So if you're an MLB fan, you're not suddenly going to get an email about finance, for example. We make sure that the content not only speaks to that audience, but it also speaks to a fan audience. So a great example is within the US, our talent roster includes Joe Maddon, who is legendary manager. And he did a whole content series with us around those impulse decisions that you make that are also based on data. So that mix of instinct versus insight, and in the moment, how do you make the right decision? Now, that speaks very strongly to a fan audience. It's Joe Maddon. He's talking about his history, why he made the decisions he made. But it also speaks really strongly to our CFO audience, because they're doing that every day in their businesses. So we could use that content across both our fan channels, but also using the MLB fan data specifically for CFOs. So yes, the data that we collect on fans is super important.
And what are the kind of KPIs that you use in order to make sure that you're hitting those kind of those metrics? And you don't need to go into, obviously, details or any confidential information, but how do you then ensure that each of the partnerships is delivering against what your objectives are? Talking to the CEOs, getting first party data in the UK for small and medium sized businesses. What are the kinds of things that you track and make sure that you're hitting?
Yeah, so our North Star is econometrics. We are tracking what impacted a customer's decision to buy from us. So in all of the marketing mix, what have they seen? What have they engaged with, which led to them purchasing from Sage? And so we can then directly track a kind of ROI model of rights and activation spends versus bookings. And that's our North Star. And there's a bit of a lag on that, right? Because the purchase cycle tends to be slightly longer, particularly in the US. But eventually we start to see the impact sponsorship within econometrics. But there are myriad of other tools that we use to measure impact. Going back to my point around reputation, so we use a tool called RepTrack, where we directly track our reputation in core markets. And we look at what's important to our audiences when they think favorably around us or our competitors. And we can directly link some of our activity to impact on reputation in our core markets. Again, a bit of a lag, but that's, again, one of our kind of key metrics is reputation impact. And then as we go further down the funnel, we can track things. We also track, obviously, web traffic, but also conversions within the website, bounce rates. We have nurture journeys where we can track at what point customers entered and exited and whether they'd seen any sponsorship content on that journey and what impacted that, right down to, and then if we look at employees, for example, so colleague satisfaction, NPS scores around their experience of working at Sage and whether any sponsorship touch points have been part of that journey. I could go on about this forever. So we have dashboards across all of our properties where we can see the impact that our sponsorship's having. But when I have a C-suite conversation, it's got to be econometrics. We've kind of got to be able to demonstrate that we're seeing return on investment based on the investment that we've made.
And would you expect that to be one for one, more than one for one? What can you tell us about that?
We would expect... I mean, candidly, we were not expecting to see an econometric impact in the first few years of our sponsorships. We all know sponsorship's a long game. It takes a while to build that emotional connection with it. And even just recognition that we're in the sports that you're watching. So we actually expected it to take a lot longer. In Europe, we have seen a positive econometric result across the sports that we operate in. And actually, we saw that in year one. In the US, we've only been in market for 1 year, so we haven't actually had our econometric results yet. And I would be hugely surprised, given our brand awareness, if we would see an impact in year one. So I train the business that this takes a while. And so I think it's the life cycle of a deal rather than immediate impact. But yes, we have seen a positive impact. And actually, it looks like we get more return than investment.
Awesome. Well, we're coming up on the hour mark, so we should probably start to wrap it up. If you liked what you heard, please make sure to give us a like and a follow and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure to go to our website, sportsloft.co, and sign up for our regular newsletter. And also make sure to follow us on socials at SportsLoftHQ and tell us what you think of the podcast and all the content that we pump out. All that remains is for us to say a huge thank you to our guests. Thank you to my co-host, Charlie, who is awake far too early on the East Coast. And thank you for making it, Charlie.
Thanks for having me, Annie. It's been a great way to wake up in the morning.
A huge thank you to Jason. Charles Russell Spezies have been a friend of Sports Loft for a while, but it's wonderful to finally have you on the podcast. And we look forward to you joining again soon.
Excellent. Thanks for having me on.
And Sally, thank you so much for a really great conversation. Great to have you on, and hopefully we will get a chance to do this again sometime soon.
Thank you, Annie.
Thank you all very much for listening, and we will see you next time in the Sports Loft. Goodbye.